Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. This is Theology Thursday. Typically, we look at the news of the day from a Christian worldview. Today, we look at the source of the Christian worldview, God's Word.
1 Samuel chapter 1. The book of Samuel brings us from the period of the judges to the period of the kings. In the time covered by this book, Samuel the boy grows up to become a man, anoints the first king in Israel, that's Saul, and later anoints a successor to take Saul's place, King David. This 31-chapter book records Samuel's death in chapter 25. And the book ends with the Philistines' defeat of King Saul in battle, and the ignominious death of the king and his three sons. So David gets anointed to be king in this book, 1 Samuel, but he's not installed upon the throne until much later at the beginning of 2 Samuel. And David's son Solomon, he comes on the scene in 1 Kings. That's when he becomes king. So 1 Samuel brings us from the time of the judges into the period of the kings, the first king, Saul. Now, if Samuel dies in chapter 25 of this book, and it's 31 chapters long, then who in the world wrote the book? And who wrote 2 Samuel? The primary prophet that ministers in 2 Samuel is Nathan, and following him is Gad. So it turns out that these books of 1 and 2 Samuel are written by three men, Samuel, Nathan, and Gad. Originally in the Hebrew, there was not two books, 1 and 2. It was one, the book of Samuel. We could say that the technical title for the book was the book of Samuel, Nathan, and Gad. Please turn to 1 Chronicles chapter 29. Normally, we don't turn to a book just to read a single verse, but in this case, I'd like to do that. It's customary for the Jews to take the first of a list and let it stand as an abbreviation for the whole, just as the Hebrew Bible presents itself in three parts: the law, the prophets, and the writings. And the Bible, as well as the Jews, would often refer to the whole thing as just the law, because it's the first of the three parts, so taking the first for the whole. So too here, the book of Samuel is named for the lead character in its opening setting, and it stands for the book of Samuel, Nathan, and Gad. 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 29. Now the acts of King David, first and last, indeed they are written in the book of Samuel the seer, in the book of Nathan the prophet, and in the book of Gad the seer. So that is the book. The first half of that work is before us now in this study of 1 Samuel. The major characters throughout both halves of the story are Samuel, Saul, and David. Then there are minor characters, or let's say primary supporting characters, Samuel's mentor, who is the priest Eli, and Saul's son Jonathan. And then there's a host of minor characters, including Samuel's mom Hannah, Eli's wicked sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and Goliath, David's wives, and others. So those are the characters. Now let's begin 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1. Now there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim, of the mountains of Ephraim. And his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuf, an Ephraimite. So they were from the tribe of Ephraim in the mountains of Ephraim. Now, Elkanah's hometown was named Ramatham Zophim, and probably named after its founder, Zuf, the last guy on the list there, and the first guy of his particular family branch in the tribe of Ephraim. They were in the mountains of Ephraim. Now, recall that each of Israel's tribes had its own territory. After they entered the promised land and they conquered it for the most part, and Joshua took a map, drew division lines, and they cast lots, and they decided which tribe would settle in which chunk of land. Simeon, for example, was in the far south, and Dan was way up north in Galilee, Simeon way south in the Negev. Ephraim was centrally located in Israel, as was Manasseh. And these are the two sons of Joseph. So they weren't really full tribes. They effectively became full tribes, but they were the half-tribes, because Joseph was one of the 12 sons of Jacob, and he had two sons in Egypt, and they became tribes. Now, that's a little bit strange, because that would give you 13 tribes, because you didn't normally count the tribe of Joseph. Instead of Joseph, you'd count Ephraim and Manasseh. Or if you counted Joseph, as sometimes the Bible does, you wouldn't have 13, you'd have 14. So how does that work? Well, God at times might not want to count the tribe of Levi because they had a special role. So in that case, instead of having 11 tribes, you pick up one of the half tribes and you got 12. At other times, God would be angry at a particular tribe for doing something especially evil. Like, well, I don't want to describe some of the things right now and get off on a tangent, but certainly the various members of the tribes of Israel, even going back to the founders of those tribes, did very evil things. And God would get very angry at them and list the 12 tribes and omit one because he was angry at them. So in that case, he omits one, he picks up a half tribe, he always has 12. So it gives him flexibility. And it reminds me of when Judas killed himself, and so the remaining 11 disciples cast lots, and they chose Matthias to fill up the number of 12, 12 being the number of Israel's kingdom, the number of God's earthly government. This town they live in, Ramath, the beginning there, Ramath means height or elevated place. And the Middle East has many elevated places, hills, and there are various Ramaths in the Bible, in Israel, in Palestine, including Ramath Negeb, that is Ramath of the South, it's called both things in the Bible, Ramath Lehi, which means jawbone, and that's where Samson slayed the Philistines with the jawbone, and Ramath Mitzpah, which means watchtower, or the watchtower heights. This Ramath Zophim probably refers to the town of Zuf in the home district of Samuel. Later in the book, chapter 9, verse 5, we see that town, the name of that town, coming into the story. It's north of Jerusalem in the land of Bethel, between Bethel and Shiloh. All right, verse 2. And he had two wives. The name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now this Elkanah, he had two wives. And we have talked about polygamy in previous studies. Abraham had multiple wives, as did Jacob, David, and others. By the New Testament, God instructed Paul of the qualifications of an elder that he should be a one-woman man, not two or more wives or women in his life. The effects of sin have destroyed so much of paradise, the paradise that God designed initially, and then it's also gone on to destroy even the makeshift existence we have in the sinful world. Over time, things often get worse. I think that society had become so cruel that polygamy, which may have been workable initially, became unworkable and unbearable to maintain. So God tells Paul to give these standards that there's to be no polygamy. And to keep their sanity, the men all agreed to it. I'm sorry. The women, that's right. It was worse on the women than the men. Now people say, yeah, but the qualifications Paul gives out where he puts down polygamy and basically affirms monogamy, those don't apply to the rank and file Christian. They're just for the elders, the deacons, the bishops. And they say, where is the prohibition for polygamy for the standard Christian? Well, in that argument they make, here's an error that creeps into it. They imply that there's a higher standard of holiness for elders and deacons and a lower one for normal Christians. That's not true. There's only one standard of holiness, and that's God. The only real qualification for being a pastor or a deacon is if you are living as a Christian should live. You don't have to attain to a higher level of righteousness that God doesn't ask of every believer. So if we look at the qualifications for being an elder, they're blameless, temperate, sober-minded, being of good behavior, hospitable, able to teach, gentle, not quarrelsome, not given to much wine, not covetous, ruling his house well, having children in submission with reverence, and having a good testimony. Now, does God want these exemplified only in the lives of the leaders or of all believers? Of course, all believers. So when God includes in that list monogamy, being the husband of one wife, that too naturally applies to every believer, not just the pastor. So the dispensation of grace which Jesus gave to Paul for us in the body of Christ, it includes various changes in the way that we are to live. The change from polygamy to monogamy is only one among others, such as the change from circumcision to uncircumcision, or from a restricted diet to potluck, or from keeping the feast to not keeping them. So there we see the transition. If we want to live honoring God regarding the issue of marriage, from the Old to the New Testament, particularly to the ministry of Paul and the onset of the body of Christ. Now, feminists claim that men have made all the rules. We see over and over that that breaks down. If men made the rules, then why did they do away with polygamy? I don't think the average guy in the street would have, personally. Why would they have said that a man must commit himself to one woman for life and provide for her, even if he loses affection for her, he still has an obligation to her? Why would men have made up that rule? Obviously, the majority of men are not altruistic, and the moral demands that flow from God, men have done all that they can to circumvent them. So men are not the ones propping up these lofty ideals and then undermining them. Men just try to undermine them. God is the one who gives us the morality, the laws. Many he gives us just through our creation and our conscience, and others he affirms through the direct revelation, the special revelation of the Bible. Hannah had no children. Anciently, children were more readily considered a blessing than they are today in America. And even in less developed countries today, children are a more valued treasure than they are here. Today's culture marks children as a burden. You already have one child. Why would you ever want another? You hear that from liberals to a couple that is trying to have a second child. I have good friends. They have 10 kids. And at times, a rude woman in a store will look at the mom and say, "I'm glad it's you and not me." And she will respond, "So are my children." So Elkanah's wife Peninnah was all set. She had her kids. But Hannah would grieve without a child. She wanted a child and she had none. Of course, that pain is no less severe today than it was for couples back then that want a child but cannot get one. And we have a number of friends, families, who eagerly are hoping to have a child, and that's difficult. Hannah was suffering that pain. Notice how quickly God sets up a compelling story. Here we are. How far have we gotten into the book? Two verses. We have a man who lived in the town where his family has lived now for five generations. As was typical, he was a polygamist. He had two wives. One had children, the other did not. Your intuition could see a whole range of social dynamics at work in this guy's life after this brief opening. Verse 3. This man went up from his city yearly to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Also, the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. As we will see, Eli not only had two sons, but he also had daughters. But the daughters, they didn't figure into this unfolding story. These two sons of Eli, they're mentioned here because they're going to play key roles over the next few chapters. But where were they? Well, Shiloh. They were in Shiloh, and that's, again, in Ephraim, north of Jerusalem, sort of in the center of Israel. If you can imagine a triangle on the map of Israel, with the base being a line drawn from Jerusalem to Jericho, and then make an approximately equilateral triangle going to the north, where the top point of the triangle would be in Shiloh. That's about where Shiloh is in central Israel. And so this man went to worship in Shiloh. And why didn't he go to Jerusalem to worship? Why Shiloh? Well, remember where we're at in history. This book brings us from the period of the judges to the kings. The city of Jerusalem was not yet taken by Israel. It was still under the Jebusites. It would not be until King David in the next book, 2 Samuel, where he takes Jerusalem. And the temple would not be built until after David's death when we get into Kings with Solomon. So we're in Shiloh worshiping the Lord. Remember the Ark of the Covenant that God instructed Moses to build in the wilderness? They put the Ten Commandments in there, Aaron's rod that budded, his walking stick, and they also put the manna, about a quart of manna in there in this box overlaid with gold, carried with wood sticks, held through rings of gold and never touched. Well, that ark was there at Shiloh. And so the people who honored the Lord as the feast would require, as they were able, they would go to Shiloh to worship. And notice that Eli was a priest, and his two sons were priests also. In Israel, the tribe of Eli was elect. Whether the men of Levi were godly or not, that was beside the point. They were the chosen servants of the Most High. They were the Lord's priests. Deuteronomy 18:5. For the Lord your God has chosen Levi out of all your tribes to stand and minister in the name of the Lord, him and his sons forever. So God chose Levi to minister as priest. Levi, one of the 12 tribes, and his sons forever, they're the priest. So if you have a Levite that hated God, he's still a priest. And he could still perform the function of a priest. If you have a prophet that hates God, he could still perform the function of a prophet. And so too with the king. In fact, in these books, 1 and 2 Samuel, get into Kings, we see God selecting kings, choosing them, who turn out to be terribly evil. They start good, they end up very poorly. So Eli's two kids, rebellious offspring as we will see, they both inherited the job of the priesthood from their father. Verse 4. And whenever the time came for Elkanah to make an offering, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and to all her sons and daughters. So the priest would take the offering from the people, kill it before the Lord, as Moses commanded, and then the people could often eat the food. Well, this is strange. You're offering something to God, but God didn't want the entire carcass destroyed, so he wanted the fat to be burned, and then it was valuable food, it could be eaten. And Elkanah would do so, and then give the meat to his family, and a typical family life would ensue. A dad comes home, he brings home the food, and the wife cooks up the meal. Well, it's not until, you know, the 1980s when the woman would bring home the bacon and fry it up in the pan. But it used to be the guy would get the food, the woman would cook it. Well, notice the next verse. We talked about the dynamics of the social situation described so far, including the polygamy. This next sentence is a kicker, especially for Peninnah. But to Hannah, he would give a double portion, for he loved Hannah, although the Lord had closed her womb. Wow. Now, Elkanah undoubtedly was trying to soothe his wife's fears and her hurts that she would never have a child over being barren. He wanted to be extra tender to her. But this is where polygamy breaks down. Whatever he does to try to help Hannah is going to make for an impossible situation for Peninnah. Regardless of his motives for giving loving attention to Hannah, Peninnah could hardly accept the situation. And her rival, verse 6, Hannah's rival, Peninnah, also provoked her severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed her womb. Closed her womb. God had made her barren? Well, that's a figure of speech. If God was in the business of inflicting men with ailments and every biological breakdown was from the Lord, then it would mean it literally. But all things come from God, and it was a common Jewish expression, just as it is among Christians today, that if it rained or not, the weather was from God. Now, God might have nothing to do. He might be completely disassociated from today's weather. But if it rains or not, we thank God as it has come from the Lord. When there was an earthquake, God was not necessarily in the earthquake. When there was a fire, God was not necessarily in the fire. And when there was a wind, God was not necessarily in the wind. But all could be seen as coming from the hand of God, since God made our world. And because he created the world, and with it, its attendant rules came into existence, thus God directly, through creation, gets credit for our existence, and indirectly, because he's the creator, and he put into motion these various beings, like humans and angels and others, and he put us in a setting, the earth and the universe, God can get the responsibility, however remote his influence, to some extent, for our circumstances. Because all things originated with God. Verse 7, so it was year by year, when Hannah went up to the house of the Lord, that Peninnah provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. Now, I don't mean to excuse Peninnah's cruelty to Hannah. By no means. I do not excuse it. However, I am saying that given human nature, she exhibits the behavior that we would expect in this circumstance. Given any number of similar situations, that wife would respond like this. so that the more loving the husband is toward Hannah to soothe her pain, the more spiteful Peninna will be to her, and the more miserable Hannah will become. It doesn't matter what the husband does. In these kind of circumstances, it's virtually impossible for another human being to take away this kind of pain. You can't do it. For this, only a relationship with God heals and puts in a right perspective. And then we can receive the comfort of our family and our friends. But only then. Without God's help, the only other recourse is to wait for time to put a scar over the wound and become hardened enough so we tend to forget it or ignore it. Dealing with the situation with God is a much better idea. Verse 8, then Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? And why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? I've tried that line. It doesn't work. It only makes matters worse. We have never been barren, but we've experienced something equally painful. In 1995, Cheryl and I lost custody of our four boys after I was convicted of child abuse for spanking my stepson, 5 swats on the backside with a belt. We lost custody of Cheryl's 2 boys and my 2 boys. And we shed many tears over that tragedy. And Cheryl was very difficult to comfort. I tried hard to soothe her, to distract her. But how do you make up for a lost child or for no child? Am I not better to you than 2 sons? No, is the answer. No, you're not. You might be my husband and I love you, but you are not my child. And I want my child. So now this is 5 years later, I now have custody of my 2 boys. Cheryl's oldest son is an adult. He's in the Navy. But we are so glad to see the letters that are going back and forth and how wonderful they are and all the joy they bring to Cheryl, because he seems to be more free now that he's an adult. And this court order and the restraining order is not hanging over his head the way it was just until a couple months ago. So that's really neat. And now we have 2 more sons, our little ones, Zachary and Michael. And I recall when we had Zachary and then Michael, I recalled Eve thanking the Lord for giving her Seth a replacement for Abel, who had been killed, who had been taken away. And it's not really a replacement, like when Job lost all his children and then he had more children. That's not a replacement. They don't take the place, but they help to ease the pain. Yet the hurt still remains. But in the Lord, there's tremendous hope.
Stop the tape. Stop the tape. Hey, this is Bob Enyart. If you would like more, either go to our store online at kgov.com. You could get a Bible study, a sermon, or subscribe to our Bible studies and our sermons. May God bless you.